Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Hilary Carlip. Hilary Carlip, author of Girl Power, has written commentaries for National Public Radio and is a performer and artist. She is the creator of the acclaimed personal essay website FreshYarn.com, and she lives in Los Angeles. You can find out more about her at her website, QueenOfTheOddballs.com. Her latest book, Queen of the Oddballs and Other True Stories from a Life According to Plan, was published by HarperCollins in 2006. Welcome. How are you doing?
Thank you. Good. I'm just going to point out it's a life unaccording to plan.
How did I do
the
that?
The subtitle is unaccording, and that's kind of the gist of the whole thing.
Yeah, I apparently missed the whole point of the book.
then we just shine the spotlight on it, so that was good.
Sorry. Okay. And one thing that I know that was not in the bio is that you were a guest on Oprah and Ellen's show.
I have been. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, I would put that right in the middle of the bio.
Well, the Ellen happened after the book came out. Okay. That was recent. And Oprah is the final chapter of the book. It's the chapter called Finding the O in Oprah. So, you know, leave some things to surprises.
That's right. Okay. So why don't you begin with something from your book?
Okay. I'm going to just set it up a little bit because I'm starting in the middle. But the book is really about growing up in L.A. on the fringes of celebrity and never feeling enough being myself. So at an early age, at age 8, I took on other personas. And one of them was Holly Golightly from Breakfast at Tiffany's. And when I took on that persona, I was smoking on the school playground and got suspended from the third grade. So not only did I get suspended, I then got sent to a child psychologist, Dr. Troop, who will make an appearance in the excerpt I'll be reading. And I was also chosen out of everyone in my elementary school to appear on television on Art Linkletter's house party. So I was picked up from school in a limo, 8 years old, with my teacher who basically kept drinking in the limo. It was morning and putting lowering the windows down and waving at people. So we're coming in right after that. A half hour later, we pulled up to CBS Television City at Beverly and Fairfax, and a tall man in a suit with a lot of Brill Cream in his hair ushered us in. As we walked down the shiny hallways, I kept my eyes peeled, hoping to spot Lucille Ball or one of the girls from Petticoat Junction. No such luck. But we did see Red Skelton rehearsing his show, and he shook my hand. I had never seen him in anything other than black and white. He was so, well, red. The Brill Cream man whisked me into a tiny room where the three other kids who would appear on the show with me were waiting. The one other girl wore a fancy lace dress and shiny patent leather shoes. The two boys wore dark suits and ties. I was embarrassed. They were all dressed for a formal party, while I was dressed for a hootenanny. A brunette woman who looked like a movie star sauntered in and introduced herself as Dorothea M. Fitzgerald. "But you can call me Miss Dorothea." She wore lipstick as bright as Red Skelton's hair. After she asked us a few questions, she led the four of us onto a stage where we were seated side by side in white woven metal chairs. I spotted my mother and brother on bleachers in the crowded studio, where an expert whistler was warming up the audience by whistling the theme to Channel 9's Million Dollar Movie. The hot lights beat down on me. I heard a man counting down, 5, 4, 3, 2, and around us the studio signs blinked applause. The audience obeyed, clapping loudly as Art Linkletter dashed onto the stage. After he made some joke, he began asking the boy beside me some questions. Personal questions. And right then and there, it sank in. Art Linkletter was going to ask questions of me, not of any other character or personality, but of me. The audience laughed and clapped at the clever things the boy next to me said, and before I could even take a breath, Mr. Linkletter was kneeling by my chair, thrusting the microphone into my face. I heard Dr. Troop's words echoing through me. "Why do you want to be other people when you're such a fascinating young lady yourself?" But all my shyness washed over me, and I couldn't utter a word. Everything began to move in slow motion. I felt the bright heat of the lights on my head, the glare of the camera in my eyes, the mounting pressure in my chest as my heart pounded loudly and slowly, steady and hypnotic. And then, still in slow motion, I saw myself talking to Mr. Linkletter, but I couldn't hear a word I was saying. Only a distorted facsimile of my voice disembodied out in the studio audience like some skilled ventriloquist trick. I wanted to cry. I wanted to go home and pet my dog, Laddie. I felt as if my simple shift with the bouncy bow had vaporized into thin air, and I was completely naked on stage in front of millions. As Mr. Linkletter stood, I snapped out of my trance. This was my last chance. I had to say something funny or I'd be a big flop and my life would be entirely ruined. If I couldn't do it as me, then I'd call on one of my other personas. Act as tough as the girl from Uncle, as spunky as Pollyanna, as carefree as Holly Golightly. "Last question for you, Hillary," Art said into the microphone. "What's your favorite thing your mom cooks?" Out of nowhere, as if I were a medium channeling some ancient hayseed deity, I suddenly was Ellie Mae Clampett from the Beverly Hillbillies, thick southern accent and all. "Well, Mr. Linkletter, she makes some mighty fine vittles, cooks up all sorts of critters." The audience went crazy. Art Linkletter was laughing so hard he had to wipe a tear from his eyes. I did it. I was so relieved I basked in the applause and smiled during the whole time the last two kids were interviewed. A man's voice announced parting gifts as a woman sauntered on stage and piled the items into our laps. A piece of Samsonite luggage, a watch, and an assortment of games, including Green Ghost, my favorite because it glowed in the dark. Miss Dorothea whisked us off the stage and led us to a place called the Commissary, where our chaperones met us. Mrs. Renzoli smiled at me, then said, "Good job, kid. Let's eat." A large woman dressed in a white uniform, hair scrunched up in a hairnet, handed us orange-speckled plastic trays and told us to help ourselves. I had been to Griswold's smorgasbord off the 10 freeway with my parents, so I knew all about buffets. I began to pile food on my tray, selecting everything white or beige, mashed potatoes, macaroni and cheese, cottage cheese, tapioca pudding. I returned for several helpings, convinced everyone in the commissary, including Red Skelton, who had just walked in, was looking adoringly at me, too shy to ask for my autograph. At home that night, I sauntered into the kitchen, knowing my awaiting public would be there to greet me with cheers. "Howard, stop that right now!" my mother was yelling at my brother, who had shredded his white paper napkin into French fries-shaped strips and stuck them up his nose. "I hate Salisbury steak," he screeched back. "I want Swiss steak!" "You'll eat what your mother puts in front of you," my dad snapped. I sat at the table and lay my napkin in my lap. "Hey, Hill," Dad said. "Sorry I wasn't able to leave work and come to the show. How did it go?" "Well, at first I was kind of shy." "Yeah, she sat there frozen like a spaz," Howard said, then threw a rolled-up piece of napkin at me. "Nonsense. She was adorable," my mother chimed in. "Adorable?" I started to perk up. "So then Mr. Linkletter asked me one more question?" "Spaz," my brother interrupted. "Would you let me finish?" I turned back to my dad. "And, well, I made everyone laugh when I said..." The phone rang. My mom answered it and told my dad it was Mrs. Goldman from up the street, who said he had offered to help her decide where to put her new furniture. "She wants to know if you can come by now." My dad, a latent interior decorator, smiled. "Sure, tell her I'll be right over." I stood up and left the kitchen. I heard my dad calling, "Sorry, Hill, tell me more when I get back." As I walked up the stairs to my bedroom, I channeled Holly Golightly once more, English accent and all, whispering, "You don't have to worry. I've taken care of myself for a long time." Again, for days, I barely left my room. My mother forced me to go with her to Party Smarty, where she picked out colorful paper plates for one of her upcoming dinner parties, and every afternoon she insisted I ride my bike. Whenever she asked me what was wrong, I just said nothing. How could I explain? At the end of the week, she walked into my room without knocking. "Nanny sent you something." I lit up, envisioning my grandmother, who lived in Columbus, Ohio, sending me one of her famous packages of homemade cookies piled in layers of wax paper, thin leaf-shaped shortbread delicately covered in chocolate, butter cookies with dots of raspberry jam in the center. But my mother handed me an envelope. It was addressed to me in my grandmother's distinct, curly handwriting and was stamped, "Do Not Bend." I opened it and found a stack of black and white photographs of Art Linkletter's house party. I looked closely at the snapshots. there seemed to have been some mix-up at the photo lab. My grandma had mistakenly sent pictures of some other girl from some other place in time. This girl was laughing. She even had a gleam in her eye. As I studied the photographs, familiarity came into focus. I noticed the striped shift with the white Peter Pan collar and bouncy bow, the forehead fringed with messy bangs. I began to recognize who that child was. It wasn't Ellie Mae Clampett, Pollyanna, or even Holly Golightly. It was the little girl Dr. Troop found fascinating. It was me.
If you just tune in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Hilary Carlip, reading from her new book, which is entitled Queen of the Oddballs and Other True Stories from a Life Unaccording to Plan. It's such a great story, and you know, you can just see Art Linkletter bending over and talking. It's terrific.
Thank you. The great thing that I was very happy about the book was I was able to include photographs and letters and ephemera. So my grandmother, actually the pictures that she sent, I still had, and they're in the book.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. I want to ask you about the voice in the writing. It's such a great voice and so many details. And, you know, as fiction writers or poets, we're always searching for these details, but they're throughout your writing. And, you know, this is nonfiction, so I'm just imagining your life was full of these details.
It definitely was. And the great thing is I have been keeping journals and date books since I was 13.
Okay.
So I did have the opportunity to go back and really find, like, exactly what was going on mm-hmm. then and what I was wearing. And, you know, so
That's
the details
great.
Are all very true and of the time.
Yeah, down to the white woven chair and every little piece. I want to ask you about a sense of the real. As someone who grew up in L.A. and had all these movie star friends like Carly Simon, and the book, of course, is about that in a way, you know, taking on personas, and how, as a child growing up, do you negotiate this sense of the real, or is that possible in L.A. with all these movie stars?
Well, to me, you mentioned Carly Simon. There's a chapter about befriending her when I was 14, and also Carole King, who was the hottest singer at the time. And to me, even throughout the whole book up to the present, it's never been about celebrity. It's been about incredibly talented people that I've felt very inspired by. And it wasn't like I needed to know her because she was famous. It was like, oh, my God, she's so talented. I have to know her. So to me, that was always very real. And the taking on of other personas, which continued on and does so in the book, to me, it wasn't really the teetering on the unreal because I was very conscious and aware of what I was doing. It allowed me to just navigate in a, like if I was a character, like I had this all-girl, all-ex-con band. And as Angel, who was this ex-con supposedly, I could literally bust into a radio station and say, here, play this. Mm-hmm. As me, I would never do that. Mm-hmm. So it made things just very comfortable and workable for me.
Mm-hmm. I love, you know, at the very beginning of the book, including Dr. Troop, which I thought was a great name for a psychiatrist.
Yeah. Yes.
And the psychiatrist saying, there's nothing wrong with her. She's fine. I love that.
Well, and meanwhile, the description of the psychiatrist, she was completely deformed. I found out later it was just terrible, terrible arthritis. But she literally, like, had a claw and her a snarl. And she was so scary looking to an 8-year-old.
Wow.
And yet she was the only one at the time showing an interest in me. So I just loved her, mm-hmm. even despite how scary looking she was.
Yeah. So, you know, not to get too analytical, but you know, as you use these personas and as you grew up, you know, is this still something that you use to get around the world? I mean, it seems like a good idea.
You know, it's really funny. Actually, this happened today. I have, throughout the book, since I was 14, I've had this alter ego, Madeline Evans, who has been at different times my PR person, my assistant, and I still use that name for certain things. And I got an email yesterday to Madeline for some PR matter, So as much as I think I don't still do it, yeah. I think there's vestiges still.
Yeah. I think that's a good idea, though.
Right? Come on.
The publicist, yeah.
Yeah.
I can use some of this. Okay, how about reading some more?
All right. I'm going to read a piece. I'll just begin, and you can tell me if we can get the whole thing in or not. But this is the title of the book, the chapter, Queen of the Oddballs. I sit anxiously in a waiting room, sandwiched between an enormously overweight woman dressed like a chicken and an old toothless fiddler. A wiry, bearded man standing in front of me deeply inhales a cigar, then blows smoke rings into different shapes, hearts, squares, crosses, while a young black woman in an ill-fitting peach-colored suit bursts into riffs as if she's testifying to Lord Jesus. I'm a 19-year-old chubby girl squeezed into a black sequin gown with a fur wrap draped over my shoulders and carrying three juggling balls in a gold lamé purse, so who am I to judge? Although we are all chatty and sweet to one another, in truth, we're fierce competitors. After all, only one of us can win the gong show. We're moments away from taping in front of a live studio audience when in walks Chuck Barris, the lovable, bumbling host who years later, in his autobiographical tell-all book and subsequent movie, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, will reveal that he's a CIA assassin. Hey, everybody, he claps his hands, shifting from one foot to the other. We've got a lot of great stuff today, so just have fun. His mischievous smile is endearing, and his messy hair comforting, despite the fact that he may have just returned from offing someone. The taping begins. Smoke ring guy is the first one called to the stage. The rest of us watch the show on a monitor in the beige green room. This is the first time we're seeing the acts we're up against, and I am at once relieved and frightened to discover that most of the oddballs I've been hanging out with all day are not just talentless, they're utterly delusional. But wait, do they think I'm like them? No way. I'm a professional. I've been reviewed. The Herald Examiner said I deserved 10 encores. The Los Angeles Times thought I was doing important work. And the Santa Cruz Sentinel called me extraordinary. Damn, maybe appearing on the Gong Show isn't the career move I thought it would be. What if millions of people watching think I'm deluded too? Worse, what if I get gonged? I take a deep breath, trying to calm myself down without inhaling too much of old toothless fiddler's B.O. Smoke Ring Guy receives a score of 14 out of a possible 30. Next up is Big Fat Chicken Lady, whose act consists of telling bad "Why did the chicken cross the road?" jokes, and after each one, belting out "Squawk!" She's not gonged by just one of the judges. She's gonged by all three. Dejected, she returns to the green room and exclaims, "I got gang-gonged!" But the old fiddler who is up next takes me by surprise. Not only does he give a kick-ass performance, he's so damn cute playing turkey in the straw and flashing his toothless smile that when the judges give him 29 out of 30 points, I'm thrilled. That is until I realize he now has the score I have to beat. By the time the producer calls my name, I am so nervous, sweat has gathered under my politically correct unshaven armpits. A masculine woman wearing a headset leads me to the stage and instructs me to wait behind the curtain for my cue. I hear the stage manager's countdown, 5, 4, 3, 2, and Milton DeLug and the Gong Show Band strike up the familiar Gong Show theme song. I've watched Chuck Barris doing his shticky intros countless times, but this one's for me. I listen intently. This next act will have you holding your breath. She has a great act, but a lousy perfume. Let's hear it for Hillary Carlib. And I'm going to skip ahead, but just describe my act, which is a torch song called I Really Get a Kick When He's Around. And as I'm singing, every word that I sing corresponds with a juggling trick. So I really get a kick. I kick the balls off my feet. When he's around, the balls go around. He's always on my mind. The balls go off my head. Our love is a bust. They go across my bust, etc. So I do the song. And I'll get back into it here. I slow down the verse and launch into, and then when I tell him to watch it, he tells me I'm just being crotchety. And you can imagine where the balls go on that line. the audience and judges howl, forcing the band to vamp until the laughter dies down. I finish my routine and return the balls to my purse. I'm so relieved to have made it through the whole song without dropping a ball or getting gonged that when Chuck Barris moves toward me, arms outstretched, I lean in to give him a great big hug. I can't stop smiling. Not because I'm relieved, but because my extra dry top lip is sticking to my gums. Chuck turns to the judges. So what do you all think of Hillary Carlip? Elkie Summer, the foxy fraulein destined for Love Boat guest star status, shouts, fabulous! I give her a 10. Next, the sassy, saucy songstress, J.P. Morgan, says, you're sensational. You do everything right. And I receive my second perfect 10. I wait, my left leg shaking as the last judge weighs in. Cocky critic Rex Reed, Gong Show regular, has never given anyone a 10, but that's what I'll need to beat old kick-ass toothless fiddler. Everything around me begins to move in slow motion. I thought you were terrific, Rex says. I love the way you sing. I have a reputation on this show for being the mean old man of the panel. This is the very first time I have ever given a 10. I hold in the screech that threatens to burst out of my fur-wrapped throat as the audience cheers. I return to the green room where I expect to be greeted with cool, competitive snubs, but everyone showers me with warm congratulations. That was fantastic! Chicken Lady squawks as she hugs me. Spectacular, croaks an 86-year-old woman wearing a silver sequin mini dress and a huge pink bow on top of bleached blonde hair. Even old Toothless Fiddler, whom I now have officially beaten, pats me on the back and lisps, marvelous. I'm going to cut ahead to the final paragraph. Okay. I tie with Cheryl Lynn, who goes on to have a huge disco song, Got to Be Real, but I won over Cheryl Lynn. So the very last paragraph of this is, but today I am the winner. And not just because I prevailed over future disco sensation Cheryl Lynn. I also won a high-speed waltz with a confetti-tossing midget, a kiss on the lips from a professed CIA assassin, a hug from a lady dressed like a chicken, and a pat on the back from an old toothless fiddler. I am surrounded by a posse of oddballs, and today I am the queen.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the writer Hillary Carlip. She's reading from her new book, Queen of the Oddballs and Other True Stories from a Life Unaccording to Plan. That's such a great story. I love it.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. When I've been on tour, I actually reenact the song, the comedy juggling song.
Really?
Within the piece. So
it's just too bad
enjoy.
For our Prosody audience that we can't do that. I do want to ask you, though, about putting the book together. I mean, obviously you have these diaries, but where did you get the idea to compile this, and how long of a process was it?
I had started these as personal essays and started reading them at spoken word events. And from that, I realized people just love these true, revealing stories. And I actually started a website called Fresh Yarn, which is devoted to personal essays. And at the time, I was doing every 3 weeks. Right now, since I'm on tour, I've been doing every 4 weeks. But I include 6 new pieces, personal essays, by a variety of fantastic authors from well-known and also people who are well-known but in other fields, and also first-time writers who have never been published. Mm-hmm. So once I started doing that and just being immersed in that world, I thought it was just time to also tell my own stories.
Mm-hmm. So this just came out a couple months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And how long did it take to compile it, put it together? I guess I'm sure you did a lot of revising and writing. And
I did. Even now when I read, I was like, I could change that line. You know, you still want to revise after the fact. But it took probably a year or two mm-hmm. on and off of, mm-hmm. you know, combined with life and all the other things and doing Fresh Yarn.
Mm-hmm. And when you were 8 years old writing this, you had no clue.
Not a clue.
This could be your book.
Not a clue.
That's a good story. Okay, we have time for a couple more things, if you have some shorter pieces.
Great. Well, I'll read an excerpt. This is from a piece about, which takes place in the late 90s, after my father had died. And my mother, I was like, you know, Mom, what can I do for Mom? anything you want to do. You know, I thought she'd say go shopping, join a book club. And all she wanted to do was go to Las Vegas, which to me is my personal hell. So strangely enough, every year we went, it became a yearly sojourn of torture. Every year we went, someone well-known died. And there was always breaking news, and people would be huddled around the television sets. And so I'm going to read just a little excerpt of 1998. And I was actually, this time I recruited my girlfriend to come with me, who's a Pittsburgh native, by the way. And so that's Maxine, and that's who she is in this story. So this time, 1998, the celeb happened to be Mr. Las Vegas himself, Frank Sinatra. I ran back to the room to tell Maxine. For the next 2 hours, we huddled on the bed watching the coverage and imagined how the city would pay homage to the chairman of the board. Frank's likeness would be carved into butter sculptures at all the $12.99 buffets. In his honor, the Liberace Museum would temporarily shroud the world's largest rhinestone. Men would eat ham and eggs off of hookers' boobs like Frank did, according to Kitty Kelly's unauthorized biography. Were they sunny side up? That seems redundant with boobs. I would have gone with scrambled or a nice cheese omelet. It was time to meet Mom in the lobby, so we headed down in the elevator. We gasped when we heard the piped-in music playing The Lady is a Tramp and wondered if it was just a coincidence or if the Muzak programmers had already begun their tributes. When the elevator doors opened, I was immediately assaulted with all that I hate most about Vegas. A cloud of toxic smoke in the shape of an iron lung hovered above the pie-gowed poker tables. The casino smelled like a nauseating combo platter of stale beer and white diamonds, Liz Taylor's perfume, which years later would provoke a bus driver to go berserk on an over-scented passenger. I heard buzzers and whistles and bells and sirens like France during the occupation, and I even saw an old man at a roulette table smoking a cigarette through the tracheotomy hole in his neck. Mom was waiting by longtime bachelors Siegfried and Roy's white tigers on display behind glass. "Did you hear?" I asked. "Hear what?" Max broke the news. Old Blue Eyes shut his peepers for good. Frank Sinatra passed away. My mother gasped. "That's so sad." She welled up with tears and opened her purse to find a Kleenex. "Oh, sorry," she said, embarrassed when she noticed her nicely manicured hands had turned black from the coin she'd been handling all morning. "You girls go ahead to the buffet. I'll wash and meet you there." My mother caught up with us between the omelet bar and the make-your-own waffle station. We piled our plates high with empty carbs and moved to a booth. "Mom," I said, chewing on a cold, rubbery waffle, "don't you think it's kind of weird that whenever we come to Vegas, someone famous kicks off?" She looked up from her oversized, most likely genetically enhanced corn muffin. "Yeah, it is kind of strange." "Maybe we just better stop coming," I declared. It goes on, in perfect timing, as if they magically appeared just to illustrate my point. Cher, Michael Jackson, President Clinton, and Marilyn Monroe sat down in the booth next to us with plates of Eggs Benedict. And it continues on.
Unfortunately, we're out of time. It went so quickly. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's the writing of Hilary Carlip, and I want to mention the title again, Queen of the Oddballs and Other True Stories from a Life Unaccording to Plan. You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Joseph Wilk, Lauren Wolf, and John Belch. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.